Hello and welcome to High and Low, a Kurosawa podcast. I'm your host Spencer, and with me is J Dog, aka Joel.
I am known as the Judo Master of Southern California. You may call me Sanshiro Torres. No, hey, I'm Joel Torres. What's up?
What's up? So,
Spencer, I just gotta ask off the bat here. Have you taken any martial arts in your life?
How many years has it been? I took Ichinryu style karate between fourth grade and sixth grade.
Well, I believe if you've seen the sequel to Sanshiro Sugata, Sanshiro Sugata 2, you'll know that karate has no place in Japanese martial arts.
That's correct. It's not honorable enough or something.
No. I mean, you saw that guy. He was
Yeah. I felt
it's kind
like,
of ridiculous.
Yeah, I felt like maybe Bruce Lee may have seen this. Or maybe that's just a thing. I don't know.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I'm not sure how that works. Like, I do feel like I feel like when Bruce Lee did it, it was because it was kind of like a part of the whole release of his force, you know? Like, on top of getting his muscles to move in the direction that he wanted to make the most impact, like, the yelling was also part of, like, the release. But this guy, yeah, we're not even into it, but that karate guy, he just liked making noises, like a wildcat.
Yeah, as I don't know. It doesn't seem that silly when you watch it because it's shot so well. And
no, it's great. Yeah. Yeah.
And then you think about it later, it's like, oh, that's actually kind of really goofy.
Kind of goofy.
Yeah. So this is it's not quite a very special episode, but I'm going to break the rules a little bit. This is an episode on Kurosawa's debut feature, Sanshiro Sugata, and the sequel that came 2 years later, Sanshiro Sugata Part 2.
It's a double feature podcast in this case.
Yeah.
Usually we separate them out. These Sanshiro Sugata Part 1 is only 1 hour and 10 minutes long, or
hour 15.
Maybe a little bit longer than that. It's very short.
Yeah, I should say a year. It's 1943 and 1945 for two movies. Mm-hmm. And Kurosawa finished the horse movie, Uma, but he didn't direct all of it. He directed only he finished it.
I see.
So
he was like the tag team partner for that movie?
Yeah, something like that.
I see.
Because the director who, I think is this guy. So, I have the Criterion early films of Kurosawa set, and it comes with a little essay thing, because there's no like bonus features or anything, really, on these. And so this covers how Kurosawa got into filmmaking in the first place. So he started... He started training as a filmmaker in 1936 at PCL Studio, and he worked under the director Kajiro Yamamoto, who I think he directed Uma. I got rid of my phone somewhere. You can look it up. Anyways, let's see, there's not really much on it. So basically Kurosawa was seen as like the star student, like the number one best like intern more or less with the studio, and he just wanted to direct a movie. And Sanshiro Sugata is based off of a book by Sunio Tomita, and Kurosawa, once he read like a ad for the book, he became obsessed with it, and he would check the newsstands every day just hoping the book would be there finally. And when he finally got his hands on the book, he read it, and he became obsessed with it and told the and pitched it to his studio, and they let him make the movie.
Hmm. It feels like something that would be a fairly popular subject anyways, but I didn't see any pre-existing versions of the Sanshiro Sugata story, at least, but this particular movie has been remade like 5 times.
Yeah, I saw like a 60s one, and I think one in the 80s too or something.
Yeah. So it became super popular because of this, and I think that the character, you know, of Sugata himself, he's a very, what's the name of the blind sword? He's like a Zatoichi figure, like he's undefeatable, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And that appeals to people, especially, you know, this whole honor of the Japanese martial art thing that's going on throughout the movies. Like, he's not a boisterous character, although he starts off that way. That's part of his whole origin story, and then he gets bit by a radioactive judo master. Or
yeah, it reminded me of Retro Man a little bit.
Yeah.
Although that movie came out around the same time, actually, the original that Inagaki did.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
See, the funny thing is that in this movie he becomes a rickshaw driver himself.
Yeah, I noticed.
And there's a part later in the movie where he, like, references, like, oh, this is actually something I do. I drive a rickshaw. And it's like, wait a minute, he wasn't the rickshaw driver at the beginning of the movie. And it's like, oh, okay. I guess maybe he started doing that and also studied judo or something.
Yeah. Okay, so this little tidbit will answer some questions. So when Kurosawa finished the movie, the Japanese censors were not fans of it. They thought it was too extreme. And a little director named Ozu defended Kurosawa, and he's part of the reason the movie got released in the first place.
Ozu, huh?
Yeah, Ozu.
Jimmy Ozu.
Yeah. Mr. Good Morning himself was like, hey, this young filmmaker has something on his hands and should leave him alone.
He's got potential. It's probably because they wanted Ozu to make a kung fu movie and he was just not into it. And he's like, this one's good enough. Do this.
Yeah.
Now, yeah, that's a cool story, but the whole intro to this movie where it's like, it's from the 70s and it says, like, there is, like, 20 minutes of this movie that's missing, and it's never been recovered. Like, I want to know. I assume it's the parts where in between story bits where it was like, then Sugata went with his master and fought, you know, practice on a moonlit hill and stuff like that.
Yeah, I kind of like, got that.
Yeah, like, I'm sure that would have been visually dynamic, but I don't know.
This was also a propaganda film.
For what?
Just like the superiority of like, I guess, Japanese culture.
I don't feel like I was being sold anything in particular against anything else, except for maybe judo versus jiu-jitsu.
Yeah.
Like, I do, you know.
Well, yeah, Kurosawa had to throw in some propaganda stuff to allow it to be made in the first place.
Right.
And the second one is definitely a lot heavy on propaganda.
Yeah, that's second, it's way more blatant.
Yeah.
And you know what? They're totally right.
Yeah. Nah, I forgot. Oh yeah, I remember. So the Kurosawa film The Idiot, based off of the Dostoevsky book. The Kurosawa version was originally 4.5 hours long.
Huh.
And he was like dead set on like having it be a four and a half long hour movie, or separate in 2 parts and have it play back to back. But the studio had him cut it down by ultimately an hour and hour and a half, I think. It's just under 3 hours. And if you watch it, it's good, but it's kind of choppy and weird in places. This was right after Rashomon, and he wanted to make his dream project. And all the lost footage is gone forever. No one, Toho has got rid of it.
So he wasn't even that far into his film career when he made The Idiot.
Nope, not really.
I see.
He just wanted to make his dream picture based off of his favorite book. And he went a bit overboard with a almost 5-hour movie.
The only reason I brought it up is because they didn't seem to have any problem with him make super long movies later in his life, so it's interesting that they'd be like, no, cut it down.
Yeah. But I think it's interesting that he kind of had a problem with Toho cutting stuff down.
Yeah, and he seems to have, just submitted to that because it's his job to do what they said, which is, it's something that directors in Japan just did. And that's, they weren't worried about their integrity. They were doing their job almost more.
Yeah.
It's strange.
You know, the Japanese system we've talked about before doesn't really lead to having a huge ego like the Hollywood system can lead to.
Right.
It's more just a blue-collar mindset over, I'm a profound artist, where, Ozu and Kurosawa, Kimoshita, where it's it's a thing I like to do, and this company lets me do it.
Yeah. Well, even someone Miyazaki, who's still making movies, and just unretired, didn't he?
Yeah, I thought he retired, or if he go back on it.
I think he unretired just recently. Yeah, when he talks about it, he talks about it how it's a job, and he's been doing it, and that's the way it is. It's there is an auteurship, but obviously, in other countries, it's praised that way.
No. The first Sugata film was a huge hit, and the second one was not a huge hit, because by the time it's 1945, a lot of theaters were destroyed, and so it barely got a release to begin with.
Yeah.
So it was kind of, not a lost film, but I guess, overlooked, I guess is a better way to put it.
Right.
Because of, the war happening.
Yeah. If you... Yeah, I don't have anything to say about that.
Yeah, I'm surprised movies were still being released at this time in Japan.
That is pretty weird.
Yeah, this is the same time that Momotaro Umino Shinpei, Peach Boy, was released, and that barely got released too, for kind of the same reason. There wasn't a market, really, because they were too busy with other things.
I mean, specifically, kind of a propaganda-leaning movie, especially Peach Boy is a propaganda movie, capital P.
Yeah.
And Sagata 2 has propaganda stuff that's slightly, anti-American.
Slightly?
Slightly. They don't go with a full anti-American. He doesn't look at the camera and go, America is the devil. That's how you go full-blown.
Okay.
Peach Boy is practically I'm going to kill America.
Well, it's more foreigners that aren't Japanese.
And then they specifically jump on the United States.
They do?
Yeah, at the end of the movie, kids are pretending to be the U.S.
Yeah, I remember that now.
Or attack it. In the movie itself, they attack the Europeans, and then at the end of the movie, the kids are like, our next target is the U.S. Yay!
Yeah, we all know how that turned out.
Yeah. I can only assume that other than that, they would have been making movies possibly for the people that had been occupying them. I'm sure they saw money-making opportunities there.
Yeah, maybe.
Obviously, the film industry didn't go down the toilet, so...
No, that is true. It survived. Yeah, there's not much background on the second one. Besides, like, huge hit, the studio, Toho, wanted him to make a sequel, because they'd bring him more money, but it didn't bring him more money.
Right. No one could foresee a war.
Well, the war was happening when they made the first one.
Shh. No one. Did you watch the 10-minute thing before the movie, or about the first movie, and talking about, like, how you can already see the skills that Akira Kurosawa brought to this movie, like, right from the beginning with his editing and camera movement and stuff like that?
I think that's in the cut on the DVD.
Yeah, or maybe it probably is.
I think, yeah, I'm pretty sure it's there.
It's on Filmstruck. It's just a person doing voiceover over a bunch of clips of the film. And he's just talking about how, yeah, like the whole concept. A first-time director wouldn't think that doing the kind of shot where, you know, you start at a wide shot and then you cut to a closer up of whatever you want people to focus on, and then you cut again to even closer. The point specifically they were doing was MoMA's daughter while she's like scowling at Sugata after the fight. And they're, you know, trying to film dynamically the actual fight scenes and cutting to different positions. Mm-hmm. Like, it's really interesting. Like, I recommend it if you have Filmstruck to look at that about these movies.
No, I didn't get that. I thought you were talking... Well, I read something that said the same thing. But, yeah.
Poor shit. No, I'm just kidding.
I don't have that fancy Filmstruck. I just have a DVD.
Well, whose fault is that? Come on.
I don't know. Do you want to get into the plot? What there is of a plot?
Yeah, let's stick with part one here. At the beginning of the movie, Sanshiro is on his way to the local jiu-jitsu dojo. And he wants to train under the master there. The master's name is MoMA. It's a M-O-M-M-A, so it looks like Mama, but I'm going to call him MoMA, because why not? And kind of an incongruent part that I didn't understand at first. When he gets there, they're like, oh, he's not here. He's out. He's out of town at a... I can't remember, like, something where they show off their fighting skills.
Wasn't it like an exhibition? Yeah.
Yeah. But later, when Sanshiro is sitting with all the students who are getting drunk, MoMA is there. Like, so, obviously he wasn't away, unless it's days later or something like that. But, you know, just one little bit of editing confusion there.
Yeah, there might be some missing footage.
Yeah, these goofballs are all getting drunk together, and they're saying, we're going to go ambush this guy who's talking about how great his judo is and stuff like that. And Sagata is like, what's judo? I was like, you're kidding, right? That's what this guy, Yugo, right? That's what his name is?
The instructor?
Yeah, Yano, sorry.
Yeah,
this guy Yano is saying that he calls his jiu-jitsu judo. I'm sorry, what were you saying?
He's Benkei from the Tiger's Tail.
Oh, he's Benkei?
Benkei?
Which one is Benkei?
He was the one who was trying to get them through the border. Border guards.
He's the loud one?
Yes, he was the loud one.
The one that was reciting all the, like...
Yes.
The monk thing? Oh, that's cool. And the guy who plays... Sagata Senshiro. I'm going to keep mixing up Senshiro Sagata. I'll call him Senshiro, or I'll call him Sagata.
Susumu Fujita.
He was like the head guard, yes. Right?
And he's the Darth Vader general in Hand Fortress.
Darth Vader really? Wow, I didn't place that because I guess he looks older.
Yeah, he's like a good 15 years older.
Huh.
Yeah,
I did not see that. That's crazy.
Yeah. He was Kurosawa's go-to lead man for a little bit, and then Toshiro came along and kind of took that place.
I was just going to say, he's got a very expressive face. Like, he's got a very... you'd recognize him in a crowd, but now you just said that, and I feel goofy. But, like, in this movie, he is the star of the movie, so you look at him a lot.
He's good. It's a good performance.
No, yeah, I think he does great. He does a great job. And like I said, he's kind of doing the Zatoichi thing, except for Zatoichi's always pretending that he's a bumbling idiot, and then turning out to be a badass. And in this thing, Sanshiro is not pretending to be a badass. He's or not being a badass. He's just like, I'm going to win because I have to win. It's what I'm meant to do. I'm going to do my best. Like it reminds me of Ryu from Street Fighter. I don't know if you know any of the stupid lore from those games.
No.
It's like a common trope, like, I just want to keep fighting and improve myself and fight people who are, you know, better or equal to me to improve.
Kind of like the badass samurai from Seven Samurai.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. In fact, speaking of fighting games, there is a Virtual Fighter character, I think. Mm-hmm. I think it's Virtual Fighter that is named after Senshiro Sagata.
There is?
Yeah, it's slightly different. Slightly different name.
Hmm.
Let me see if I can see that real quick while I'm talking about this. Anyways, these guys are waiting for Yano to come out, and he comes by. He's being pulled in one of the rickshaws. And the guys ambush him. Like, literally, they stop the rickshaw driver, who runs off terrified. And Sagata's kind of just standing in the back, like, not really knowing what's going on. I mean, he knows that there's supposed to be an ambush, but he hasn't even been trained. They brought him along because he's like, maybe we'll learn something. Ha 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 ha. You know? And so Yano knows what's up. He, like, takes off his hat and takes off his coat and goes and stands by this ravine. And he's like, do you know who I am? Do you understand what you're going to be doing? And they're like, we're going to teach you a lesson. And, you know, at first they individually run at him, and he judos them over into the water one by one. And the way the judo in this movie is done is, I haven't actually seen like a judo match. I don't know how it goes, but it's a lot of like grabbing onto each other's like shoulders and arms and possibly even their gi.
Mm-hmm.
And then like using the momentum and force to either push them back, like do this kind of hopping dance back and forth until one of them is able to throw the other, you know?
Yeah, judo is just based off, it's a defensive martial art, so you use their weight and like force against them.
Right, right. And he does this, he takes out each of these students of MoMA, who MoMA is also there. And at one point, they're like, oh, don't use any weapons. It's going to be dishonorable. But one of them picks up a stick because everybody's getting their butt kicks, and he easily takes care of all these guys. At the end, it's just... I keep forgetting his stupid name.
MoMA?
It's just Yano.
No, Yano.
MoMA and Sagata standing back there. MoMA finally runs up, tries to take out Yano. Yano pins his arm behind his back on the ground. And MoMA's like, kill me. Like, tell me who you are. Kill me. I'm not going to take the shame of being defeated by you. You just need to kill me. And Yano's like, I'm not going to kill you. I'm not going to, not even going to break your arm. You know, you've just learned a lesson I've taught you. And he goes to get back to the rickshaw, but the rickshaw driver is long gone. And so Sagata's like, I'm master, I'll take you. You know, he's decided that Yano is now his new master. And picks him up, and they hop away to the new school.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
And, Sugata really wants to be a judo student now instead of jujitsu.
Yeah, forget jujitsu. He just saw judo defeat all these jujitsu students and even the teacher of the class, so forget it, you know. And that whole fighting scene next to the ravine is really dark. Like, I don't know what they were doing in particular. I don't know if the actor... I mean, it seemed like it was all the actors that were doing the fighting scene. So I don't know why it was so difficult to see, like, certain parts. You know? Yeah, I don't think it's, like, not shot well. I just think there's no lighting.
Yeah, like, you see later scenes where it's better lit, and it's like the actors doing it themselves.
Yeah.
So, I don't know, maybe it's just, I don't know, maybe Kurosawa wasn't very sure how good it would look, so he purposely would make it look more like blurred, not blurred, but, you know what I mean, like having it, like,
he's purposely obscuring some of the action.
Yeah, like in a bad horror movie, you know, with Train Monster, it should be mostly dark.
Or a good horror movie, in my opinion, because I feel like one of the main flaws of a bad horror movie is they try to show you everything. It's like, no, you just need to either keep it in the dark or show us for a second, or, you know, a quick flash of violence is going to be way better than having some prolonged thing no matter what.
Yeah, like how Tarantino uses violence.
Right, exactly.
It's a short burst, but you remember it.
Yep. Except for in Django, when people are getting shot up 1,000 times.
It's still a short burst. That's just being built up for like over an hour.
I'm just kidding.
That movie is very special to me.
Ah, man, we should do a special on it. Yeah. Even though it has nothing to do with what we're talking about.
Yeah, I wouldn't mind that.
That'll be fun. So, the next scene we see is Sugata is in the town, and he is chasing after people. You can hear him from off-screen going, "What did you say about me?" And somebody being like, I didn't say anything. And he's like, "Yes, you did." You know, and you don't even know who he's really chasing. He just kind of like, this crowd is like backing away from him. And he like runs after the guy and grabs somebody. We don't know if it's the person he thought said something, and like forcefully tosses this guy to the ground. And then he turns around to the other side and runs after some other people. And it's just these two crowds on either side moving, like trying to move away from this psycho who is just, he's just pissed, you know? And anytime somebody tries to fight him back, he's knocking them out. He's tossing them over his shoulder. He gets to a point where they've kind of made a circle around him in a different place, and he's just picking random people and throwing them. And one of the random people he accidentally grabs is kind of a sumo wrestler because he tries to pull him, and he turns around. It's like big old muscular guy who just kind of smiles at him. And then when he backs up, like, oh, now this is going to be a real fight. The guy does the sumo position where, you know, you separate your feet and stand with your arms out that way.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't actually get to see the fight from that point. You know, you get to see them move back and forth. But we cut back to the dojo, where Yano is working on some scroll work. And two other students go in and say, Senshiro's back. Please be easy on him, master, okay? He lost his temper. We know that this has happened more than once. But please don't give him a hard time. For some reason, the students just really want Sanshiro to be okay. And Yano's like, I'm gonna do what I have to do here. I'm not gonna treat him any worse than he needs to be.
Sugata is a pure soul.
That is something that they say. And based on what we saw, he's got rage issues. He's got something going on.
Yeah, it reminds me of again, Rexxar man.
Yeah, yeah. And he has a kind of a reforming scene, just like Rickshaw Man, which we're building up to.
Love that fluffy cat.
Mm-hmm.
And I love Tiger too. He's so stripey.
Anyway, so Sanshiro, yeah, he shows up and he's ashamed. He's bowing his head to the master, being like, "I'm sorry." And Yano, like, he's kind of acting like the kind of father where he's like, "I've already washed my hands of you. Like, I don't think you want to do this. You know, you're too obsessed with yourself. You haven't figured out that the important thing that we do here is not your skill and your ego. It is about the martial art. It is about the Japanese style of judo that we are doing here.
It's about the superiority of Japanese
judo compared to all other skills. All other jujitsus cannot match this.
Yeah, I think that's the propaganda part in this.
That's true. Yeah. It also shows like an interesting way that people would look at that, you know, that particular art style. Yeah. Like, it is an art. Like, the martial arts are an art style. Whether it's used for violence or exhibition or, you know, like defense, things like that.
Yeah.
It's not something you can just simply pick up. So, Sanshiro is adamant that, like, he would die for the master. I would die, you know, you tell me and I'll die. And the master's like, shut up. It's like, no, I'm telling you, I would die for you, okay? You tell me to die, I will die. And the master looks at him and says, then die. And conversation's over. So Sanshiro goes outside to the pond, this disgusting pond. I assume it's disgusting. It's in black and white, but
yeah, it looks real murky and like full of trash.
Yeah, yeah. It's still, and you know, it looks like there's a bunch of, yeah, exactly. And he just goes into the pond. He gets into the pond and he holds on to this post and he's like, I'm gonna stay in this pond. I stay in this pond until I die. He's acting very childish, but I think that's on purpose. Like, you know, like if the master really loves me, he's going to save me. It's like, no, he's trying to teach you a lesson right now, which is that he isn't going to be able to save you. You have to figure out what is important to you. It's about the internal strength that you are denying that you have and that he obviously saw when he took you as a student, right?
Yeah.
And we get introduced to this monk character who I can never kind of figure out what his deal is.
I thought this was like a monastery or something, but I think he just hangs out with them.
No, yeah, I think he just likes hanging out with the bros. Yeah, and he, like, he's an ass to Sanjiro, like, or Sanjiro, he's an ass to Sagata, like, all the time, and at first he does kind of deserve it, but there are times when Sagata is asking, like, just a legitimate question, he's like, you moron, don't you know? I don't know, but yeah. At this point, he... What's up?
I really like the monk character.
I mean, I'm glad he's a character in the movie, but I wouldn't like him in real life.
Oh, no, but like, as a character in this, he's my favorite part, probably.
Right, and he does actually impart wisdom. He, like, even though he is a jerk, he teaches Sagata these lessons, and... Like, it's like, you're not going to get out of that water, and no one's going to help you. In fact, do you see what you're doing right now? And he's like, what? Like, what are you doing? He's like, I'm holding on to this stake so that I don't go deeper in the water. It's like, right, if that stake wasn't there, you would die. Think about that. And he does stay in the water for a long time, you know, several days, and the fellow students are like begging the master to give him, you know, to forgive him, and he's like, I already have forgiven him. I don't have to forgive him. He said he's going to die. If that's what he wants to do, he can, but I'm not the one who's keeping him in the water.
And then one night, while Sugata is still in the water, he sees a lotus blossom. And it's come, you know, in the middle of this trash, of this gross lake that we're talking about, this simple beauty. And that seems to unlock something inside of him. And he, you know, calls everybody out, come and look at what I've seen. You know, everybody sees this lotus leaf, and he gets out of the water and gets down on his hands and knees. And he says, Master, I understand. I understand now. And that's, you know, that's his rickshaw moment.
Yeah. It's like, it reminds me of the moment in Rhapsody in August where they're at their funeral or something. They're at the ceremony for, like, the grandpa and...
Yeah, her dead husband.
Yeah, and you see in, like, the... I think the youngest, like, grandkid is scared, and he looks at a lotus flower and sees these ants, like, escaping to a lotus flower. Do you remember that? Yeah.
I do, kind of.
Except in Rhapsody in August, it represents people fleeing from the bomb, where... In this one, it's just kind of like a...
It's like the opening of his third eye, his spirituality, his acceptance of himself.
Yeah, and the villain of the movie also has an important moment with a flower, too.
Right, when he sticks it in his butt.
No, when he... We'll get to it.
What? Okay. So we flash forward a number of years, or at least not, maybe not a number of years, but we flash forward a certain amount of time. And this is, we're going to get introduced to the movie's villain here. Sagata is outside. He is stomping on some clothes for laundering purposes. And Dracula shows up in a rickshaw. Did you think of him as Dracula?
No, but he looked like, to me, like a demon in human form to me.
Yeah. He looks like Dracula from the Francis Ford Coppola movie when he's like in town with his glasses on and stuff like that. Like, I was like, is this guy a vampire? I don't know.
He immediately looks creepy.
Yeah. But he's dressed up real nice. He's got a pencil thin mustache and stuff like that. And he's acting really weird. He, like, goes up to Sagata and he's like, you know, it's like, I need to see, I can't remember. He, like, says something to Sagata, and Sagata stops stomping, turns around and responds to him. And then they don't say anything for about 15 seconds.
I think he asks about Yano.
Yeah. Eventually he does. But he just kind of is asking these leading questions. Like, I don't know if he's trying to get a rise out of him or something like that. But every 15 seconds, Sagata's like, okay, I guess we're not talking anymore. He turns around, starts stomping on the clothes again. And then the guy asks a question after he turns his back. Sagata stops talking, turns around, or stops stomping, answers the guy's question. And the guy's just very casually, like, getting a cigarette out, getting, you know, lighting it and stuff like that. And this goes on for, like, 4 or 5 questions before finally he tells Sagata, like, I want to go see the dojo. You know, I want to meet the master. It's like, well, the master's not here, but you can come with me, and we'll see the students and stuff like that. So, and even then, he kind of has to be like, come on. The guy's, like, very casually taking his time. Like, I don't know if he was trying to seem stoic or evil, but... He did real good. I really like this guy.
Yeah, he's probably, like, for a villain, like, one of Kurosawa's best villains.
Yeah. What is his character's name? Is it Higaki?
That's his family name. His first name is...
Genosuke?
Genosuke.
Genosuke Higaki. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. You know he's evil because he dressed like a Westerner.
Yep. Oh, yeah, definitely. Although the Master Yano also has some Western, like, he wears the cape and the hat.
Well,
But he wears his...
He doesn't go, like, full, like Western style, like, pinstripe suit.
Right, that guy looked like a pimp, almost.
Yeah, like, again, I think that's another part of propaganda. Oh, if you dress like a Westerner, then that means you have no soul.
Yeah, this whole story is supposed to take place in like 1880 or in the 1880s. Yeah. Oops, I just pulled my earphones out of my head.
Yep.
but it does feel like there's some incongruent like time things. Like they're like, I don't know, were Japanese people dressing in like suits and ties?
They were open up to like the Western, to like America by then, and like baseball became a huge thing in Japan by that point. So
really, it's not,
oh yeah, baseball was massive, and it still is. But like,
well, yeah, I know that.
But like when it was first introduced, it like baseball clubs popped up everywhere, and like there's this one that played the U.S. Navy. And they scored, I think, like 50 runs on the on the U.S. team, and it was like a huge moral victory for the Japanese. There's an episode of Samurai Champloo where they play baseball as a reference to the whole baseball craze. And
the historical document Samurai Champloo.
The show references historical stuff from the late 1800s Japan.
No, I get all my history from anime.
yeah, that's a baseball episode that is a total reference to it.
I've seen like 4 episodes of that, and I always really liked it, but I just like couldn't follow through for some reason.
It's definitely worth going
through. I like its like hip hop music style and stuff like that, and I like the animation. Yeah, but I get real tired of Steve Bloom.
No, I listened to the dubbed version then.
Oh, that's a good idea.
Yeah, I listened through all of the dubbed version, and I think it's better. And I prefer it over Cowboy Bebop, which is the creator's other big hit.
You need to shut the hell up.
I like the hip-hop over the jazz, just saying.
I really like Cowboy Bebop. I haven't seen in years, but I mean, that's...
He does the same thing.
No offense to Steve Bloom, because I do think he's a fantastic voice actor, and I like his. The problem is his voice is instantly recognizable, and he's in everything. He's the new Frank Welker.
That's true.
Like in the beginning of the first Batman Arkham Asylum, there's just a random doctor who's like, "Okay, I'm gonna check your." You know, he's got the Steve Bloom voice, and it's like, "Oh man, goddamn it."
Yeah, but like,
I'm not in this wonderful world of Batman anymore.
Yeah, but Champloo does the Cowboy Bebop thing of matching up a music genre and culture with an anime thing with samurai and hip hop, and then
I really like that.
You have jazz and space adventure stuff.
That guy should do one for like punk music next.
I don't know, punk and what? I don't know, like I don't know much of anime. What's another anime thing?
Punk and magic.
I like punk and like a wizard and wizards and stuff, maybe.
Yeah.
And demons.
Yeah. Or a harem.
Yeah, maybe a bunch of punk rock chicks like a lame.
They like one kid. Dude.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway. So this guy is like, well, I want to challenge somebody while I'm here. It's like, okay, well, you can fight one of the students. And we kind of get a cut forward where we see the student that he was challenging get thrown against the side of the dojo so hard that he breaks some of the planks. And Senshiro goes over and, you know, he's comforting the guy. And Higaki's like, is there anybody else I can challenge while I'm here? You know, since Yano, the teacher's not here, because that's who I came to. He came to challenge the master of the dojo. And Senshiro's like, I'll challenge you. But it turns out that he can't challenge Senshiro because he is still in trouble for the whole, you know, starting fights and things like that. And there's a guy who, I didn't pick up the character's name, but he's like, no, the master's not here. And he put me in charge, so you're not going to fight him.
Is it one of the guys that wears a black kimono thing?
Yeah, I think it is.
Because they're the three. There's a Yano, and there's like three instructor.
Well, those are the those are the three guys that like were like saying you should be easier on Sanshiro.
Yeah, like earlier. I think they're also instructors under Yano. Like,
well, we see them later because they've like all graduated or whatever.
Yeah, but like I don't think they're ever named, or if they do, it's in the credits.
Yeah, it's not anything truly important, and they're not exactly major characters. They're just kind of like background storytellers. Like, oh, Sanshiro did this. Yeah, but so Higaki is like, I do want to challenge you, and I will challenge you one day. And I'm disappointed we can't. And he just kind of leaves. And a few days later, they do get a challenge from somebody, although it's not Higaki. He gets a challenge from MoMA, specifically to fight...
In the police tournament?
Oh, is this the police tournament one? Okay, so it's not a challenge from there. It's...
I think that's it.
No, you're right. Yeah, they're the policemen want to have a... exhibition match between all these different jiu-jitsu people to try to determine like what style they should teach all of their I won't call them soldiers because that's the way I feel like it is in the U.S. but all of the officers. And so
if you remember in Rickshaw Man, Toshiro's character gets in trouble for fighting the police judo instructor.
Right. Yeah, he gets his butt handed to him. Actually, he looked a lot like the Higaki bad guy in this one.
Yeah.
Because he was all dressed to the nines.
That is true.
Yeah. So, I'm not exactly clear on the wind-up thing here, but eventually we end up at this judo match, this jiu-jitsu match, rather, where the exhibition is going on, and... Yano warns Sugata because he's the one who's going to be taking on the people here that MoMA's a lot stronger than the last time we saw him. He just kind of says that casually. And so, well, the match happens. MoMA's being a real, like, aggressive asshole. He, like... Sagata goes forward and he does what you're supposed to do with the, you know, start of the match, you know, something honorable. I can't remember if he like literally gets down or no, he just bows. That's right. He just does a casual bow to the opponent and to the judges in the match. But, MoMA like grabs him. Like he doesn't even wait. He just goes in for the attack. And within like, 2 minutes, or not 2 minutes, within like 20 seconds of them kind of like moving back and forth, you know, after Sugata gets the grip on him, we see MoMA fly through the air, land against the corner of the dojo so hard he breaks several of the boards, and then something, the camera actually slows down. It's slow motion. You see a frame fall out from the window and fall onto him. Like, he hit it so hard, he knocked the frame out of the window on top of everything. Sugata has killed MoMA. Not meaning to. He did not mean to do that, but he is so strong and good at judo that MoMA just died during this exhibition match. And off-screen, you hear a scream. And the camera turns around, and there is a woman standing amongst all the men who were watching the match. The camera moves in twice to see this person, and it's MoMA's daughter, who we saw earlier in the movie. And she's just mad. She got a mad face.
Makes sense.
Yeah. It's all really done well. Like, I can highly recommend the part when, after we get to, like, when he's doing the exhibition mats... matches, everything is filmed so well.
Yeah, you can like, clearly
you don't feel like this is a first time director's work.
The filmmaking is already very confident.
Yeah. And Sugata is having a very difficult time with this. Like he killed a man, and there is apparently a cutscene that we see text on screen describing where him and Master Yano go out and train in the moonlight. And Sugata eventually gets over his, like, conflicted feelings after having hurt this person, killed this person. And he gets a challenge, like, from another dojo. It's actually Higaki's dojo, but he's not going to be challenged by Higaki himself. He's being challenged by my father.
Yeah.
He comes up and he's like, Joito. No, wait, that's stuff my actual dad would say.
So, in real life, does your dad do martial arts? Or like?
No, my father wouldn't know what a martial arts was if it bit him in the butt.
No, but he's a track runner, track coach?
He's a cross-country runner, oh. Yeah. He still runs several miles a day. Hmm. He's in his late 60s. So he looks like the age that this guy's supposed to be. Because the guy, what was the name of the actor? I always forget.
Takashi Shimura.
He's playing Hansuke Mori.
Yeah. Oh, Shimura always looks like 50s or 60s. He's never looked like a young man.
Yeah, but they definitely age him up on purpose. A couple, like in The Hidden Fortress, they like put gray hair and stuff on him. And this one, they're like, he's supposed to be some older woman's father. So, you know, they make him look like, oh, he's an old man at the end of his thing. But father stopped drinking. That's how much he wants to win this match. You know?
Yeah. Oh, and that's the scene where you see Higaki. He ashes out his cigarette in a lotus flower.
Yeah.
Which is the complete inverse of Sugata's like moment of brilliance when he realizes, you know, who he is with the lotus flower. So it just shows right. like the evil that he's his opposite.
Right. This also introduces us to Sayo Mirai, who is the older Mirai's daughter. And Higaki is like, he's like literally lying down in their house. It's kind of a
they're supposed to be a couple.
It doesn't have the kind of respect that I am used to seeing in Japanese movies. You know, he's very casually smoking inside and stuff like that. I would have been really shocked if he had his shoes on, but who knows? Yeah. We get the idea that they are very close, if not a couple.
In the second one, they mentioned that Sugata stole Higaki's girl,
right? And Higaki, well. No, Mori is like, oh, father's going to win. Don't worry. Agaki's like, no, he might not. I'm just telling you, this other guy's really strong. And Seo goes to a, like, I don't know what you call those places. Like, her mother has passed away, and she goes and...
A shrine?
I guess it's a shrine. At the top of some hill that Sugata also visits on occasion, like, and they're, you know, they've crossed their path every once in a while. And at one point, Sayo's slipper breaks, and Sugata like takes off his handkerchief and like rips off a piece of cloth so that he can like redo the strap on it for her. And they become close, although she does not know who he is, and vice versa. They just are spending time with each other now. Sugata, you know, asks her about her father, because she mentions her father, and she says, oh, he's training for a jiu-jitsu match, and he's going to be facing somebody, and Sugata's like, who's he supposed to be facing? Like, oh, he's going to fight Senshiro Sugata. He's like, oh, that's me. I guess we can't hang out anymore. Bye. Yeah, things got awkward for a second. There was another scene, by the way, where the daughter of Moma goes to the dojo and is like, I need to see Senshiro. I need to see him, and they, like, stop her, and she's got a huge knife. She was ready to stab him to death for revenge for her father.
Yeah, then she disappears.
Yeah, that's the last we see of her. It's just kind of a little scene. Let's skip forward. We get to the match where the older Mori my father is going to go up against Sugata. And they have a very long judo match. A lot of, like, pulling back and forth. They almost seem evenly matched. You don't know if Sugata is holding back or not.
Yeah, and your father is doing a pretty good job once they start, like, throwing each other.
Right, yeah. He flips Sugata several times. Like, he throws him, and Sugata, like, flips over, lands on his feet. So he doesn't actually get him pinned down or anything like that. But he is actually throwing him. And then eventually Sugata gets the upper hand and tosses him so hard, you know. At first, he has trouble getting up. He gets up. Tosses him again. This time, he definitely looks like he's not going to get up. But he does. He manages to pull himself up again. Sugata tosses him the third time, and he says, okay, he doesn't actually kill him. This is something that people were saying, like, this is going to be a match to the death. Except that doesn't happen. Morai says, okay, I give up. You win. And Sugata, like, is like, I'm so sorry, you know, like, he's, like, trying to make sure the guy's okay, so we know that it wasn't, like, an anger thing or anything like that. And this is when he basically replaces Hugaki in that house, because he's already warmed up to Asayo, and now he's warmed up to the father, who is convalescing.
Yeah, like, I have... Like, of older movies, like, from, like, pre-50s, I haven't really seen anything this physical in terms of, like, action.
Yeah.
Like, I was surprised, like, how the judo stuff was actually done, because I've never really... Like, when I think, like, when you see action, like, action movies, I think they start... My mind always jumps, like, oh, start in the 50s, but look at this, and it's like... Oh, directly, there were some earlier on.
Yeah.
Like, were you surprised at how it was done?
I was surprised at how well it was done. I don't...
Like, I haven't... Like, of the, like, I've seen, like, Hollywood stuff from the 50s that doesn't do action like this.
Yeah. And maybe that was part of the problem. You know, maybe Kurosawa wanted an emphasis on the fighting, and maybe that's part of why it had to be edited down so much.
Maybe. This is, for me, very jarring to see action done in a fairly modern way so early. But
yeah.
But the Japanese were doing, like, samurai stuff in the 20s. So
right.
In Japan, it was already a tradition.
Yeah. So, this obviously, now that he's stolen this potential father-in-law and girlfriend, Higaki's had enough. He challenges Sugata to a match to the death. You know, no referees, no exhibition, no holds barred.
One witness.
One witness who was the guy who originally said stop Sugata from fighting him back in the dojo back in the day. And they meet in the middle of a field. And they have a all-out throw-out fight there. You know, like, Sugata is he's already very hesitant. He doesn't want to kill another man. He already had, you know, he did that once and almost ruined his life. And this time, this guy wants to fight to the death. Higaki is not having it. So there's a lot of throwing around. There's a lot of rolling and stuff like that. Higaki looks, he's got the upper hand at some point. By the way, Seo shows up to, like, I don't know. She's kind of a foil at this point, because it's like, you're just going to just distract Sugata. Why are you here? But yeah, she's showing up, making that, you know, putting her hands to her face. And Higaki has Sugata, like, by the neck. He's, like, strangling him almost. And as Sugata is, like, slowly losing his strength, he envisions the lotus flower once again. And he gets this smile on his face. And then the match is, you know, it just changes directions completely. He starts to win. He throws him, like, really far into the field. Like, I assume this guy was dead after he got tossed that hard.
Yeah.
But it turns out he's not. I don't think you find it out this movie that he's not dead, but he's...
Don't they say, like, in a post-credits thing that he... Pre-crushing, like, he survived.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
Recovering.
But Sugata wins the match. And We flash forward a bit, and Sayo is... I believe Sayo comes looking for Sugata, and they're like, oh, I'm sorry, he left. He left on a journey, and he's going to have to figure something out before he can come back, is what he says, basically.
I think he's going to Yokohama.
Right.
Which is where part two starts.
Right. That's the end of the first movie. So I think the first movie is really well done. It does feel like it has some rather large holes in it, but I mean that is like literally explained.
Yeah, it's. I understand why it's so low ranked with Kurosawa's other work because he still figured things out. This was his first actual film.
Right,
but
I got the impression that this was a bad movie. Like his first movie was a bad movie, and it's not. It's not bad at all.
No. Like for a propaganda film, it's like, oh, this is actually a movie.
Yeah, it's well done, well acted, well dialogued, well shot, well edited. Yeah,
like the fight scene at the end where he's walking. I think you see. Is it Higaki in the field already?
Yeah, it's Higaki.
Yeah, and he's standing in the field, and it's this windy, and it's this beautiful shot of this, like, grassy field.
Yeah, it's super atmospheric. The wind is, like, constantly blowing, which adds this, like, other tension to it. Now, I think it's a very good movie, and it's, like I said, it's only just over an hour, so...
Yeah.
Now, I'll move a little bit faster through the second one, because I didn't mean to spend so much time talking about this one.
Yeah, it's understandable. We're covering two movies.
Yeah.
I think the second one doesn't have as much.
It has a lot of things going on, but it doesn't feel like it has as much substance. It feels more, once again, going back to Zatoichi, it feels a little bit empty like those end up usually feeling.
Yeah, second one... definitely feels like Kurosawa took studio notes and added a forced anti-American message in it.
Right. It's got some good stuff. Like, when it's not dealing with the anti-American stuff, it is actually pretty entertaining.
Yeah.
Because of the characters it introduces. So, we begin this movie with a very large Navy man, white American dude. Or he's not American. He's got like an accent, but I guess he's supposed to be American.
Yeah, I thought he was supposed to be American.
He's like, all right, put up your dukes. He's got like an Irish accent. But he like, the guy who's running his rickshaw, like bumps him or something like that, or accidentally tips him over.
Yeah.
And so he gets out of the rickshaw and starts beating up on this tiny little man. And he's doing the whole boxing thing. I guess he's a boxer. And Sugata just happens to show up and is like, hey, leave that guy alone. He's like, you want to fight me? All right, let's fight. I'm going to fight you. I'm going to fight everyone. You know, this guy's a real jerk. And Sugata kind of like, in the World of Warcraft days, we used to call this kiting, where you kind of like get the attention of something and then drag it over to a more, an area you'd prefer to fight at. And he takes him over by this pier. You know, kind of lets the guy swing around a bit and then, you know, tosses him in the water, naturally.
Yeah, you know, like, Sugata makes the point to, like, look at his surroundings and be like, where's the safest place to fight this guy?
Right, because he doesn't want him to accidentally punch anyone else, too. Yeah. Or destroy any of the property.
Or accidentally kill him. Which he's
I mean, you should capable. Kill him. It's fine.
Yeah, yeah but...
No, he doesn't want to. Starts off this way, and Sugata returns to his dojo. Apparently, it's been 2 years that he's been wandering. And a man comes looking for him and says, hey, I heard about that thing you did to the American. So there's another guy who is, like, the best boxer. Like, boxing is really big in the U.S., and this guy is supposed to be the best, and he wants to have a match with, like, somebody in Japan. And so we wanted to get you because you're the best. You're undefeatable. And he's like, no, I don't fight for entertainment. Like, why would I fight this guy? He's like, well, I'll give you some money. Like, no, I don't do that either.
It's against the rules.
Like, oh, okay, well, you know, come check it out if you want to. So we do go to the match, and it turns out another person has stepped up to fight this American. And Sugata, like, actually takes this guy aside and is like, hey, why are you doing this? Like, this is, like, I mean, there's no better word. It's dishonorable to Japan to, like, do this, because we don't. It's not about show, you know, a show. It's about the honor and the art of the martial arts of jiu-jitsu.
Yeah, it's, never mind.
Yeah. Well, the guy very plainly, when Sugata, like, introduces himself finally, the guy's like, well, I have to do this to have money because you've made judo so popular that jiu-jitsu has declined in popularity. So, basically, F you, you know? So this exhibition happens, and the Japanese guy gets his ass handed to him by this boxer, who's about 20 feet taller than him, I'd say.
Yeah.
He's a very tall man.
It's a very, muscular, but stringy muscle.
Right. One of those 1920s boxers.
Yeah, it's not quite not quite like a 50s body where it's kind of pudgy, but you can see the muscle. It's more like a string cheese.
Yeah. He's sinewy.
Yeah, there we go.
But this is, so we see this defeat match, and Sugata is basically disgusted by this, and he leaves. We don't really hear much about that afterwards until the middle of the movie. And
no, he watches it.
Yeah, he sees the guy get defeated, but then he just leaves. Yeah. And at this point, it's kind of a lot of, like, reunion stuff. Like, he reunites kind of with Sayo, although they don't really, you know, I think they're supposed to be in love. It's not really working out. Sayo's just kind of waiting for him all the time.
Yeah, he seems to be emotionally absent.
Uh-huh. And the rest of his goofy friends from the judo all there. And at this point, they're kind of like legends because they're like all, you know, wearing the black uniform. They're all instructors themselves. And there's a whole crapload of judo students, including the rickshaw driver from the beginning of the movie, who has joined up because he wants to know how to defend himself. And these two people suddenly show up, and they just kind of come into the dojo. They don't, you know, they don't introduce themselves. They don't bow to the sensei, you know, to Yano or anything like that. They just kind of make their way in, and everybody's like, hey, you can't just do that. Like, this is our dojo. You can't just bust in. And it's like, well, we want to fight Sanshiro.
And they have crazy wild hair.
Yeah, kind of like wild looking.
They both kind of look like Higaki.
Yeah, it's kind of weird. And one of them looks like a wild animal, and acts like a wild animal. Like, when they figure out that Sugata is there, this person keeps walking towards him, and the other person's like, "Hey!" It's like, "Oh!" It turns around, and he starts walking towards him. He's like, "Hey!" Like, "Oh!" Turns around. And finally, on the last time, he gets so mad, he goes over to the side of the dojo and breaks a couple of boards in the wall with his karate. These people are karate masters.
Yeah, karate is impure.
That's correct. And he's saying, karate is much better than judo. We could defeat any judo person, but you guys won't challenge us, so we're gonna get a fight no matter what you do, eventually. So as the movie progresses, like, more and more of these students that are, like, just trying to walk, like, to the dojo or wherever are getting, like, beaten up and, you know, ending up in the dojo, having been assaulted by these two idiots. These two idiots turned out to be Higaki's brothers, as you said. And Higaki is, like, a shell of him, his former self. Like, he like, lies in bed all day. He's been so thoroughly defeated by Sugata that he can't function, but he doesn't want revenge, and his brothers have taken it upon themselves to get revenge in his name anyway. But there's a scene later where Sugata goes to the dojo, right? He goes to the dojo to meet with Sugata.
Yes, he does.
Basically to say, like, I'm not the one who's doing this, and Sugata treats him like, you know, like a friend, yeah, like an old friend almost.
Yeah, with respect, it's very nice.
Yeah. And Higaki is very touched by this because he feels like he doesn't deserve it. Like, he says he doesn't know who that person he was before they got in the fight was. Like, he lost control of himself. And, winding up here, you know, Sugata is getting more and more upset that his students and the fellow judo, students at the dojo are just showing up, beating up. And eventually even the guy who specifically is training, the rickshaw driver, shows up, you know, beaten to crap. And Sugata takes it upon himself, like, he's already been told by Master Yano, like, you can't fight these people, like, that even if they send you a challenge, you're not allowed to fight them.
Now, did we mention that your father has passed away by this point?
Oh, I forgot about that, yeah. Yeah, in 2 years, like, they couldn't get the actor back, whatever.
He was probably busy filming, like, 3 movies at the time.
Yeah. And, Sugata takes it upon himself to try to get thrown out of the dojo. First, by drinking inside the dojo. There are 3 rules. No drinking, no fighting for money, and no, I can't remember what the 3rd rule is.
Drinking, fighting for money. Did I write down? Nope.
Fighting for entertainment or something like that? I can't
remember. I think maybe. I don't know.
But there's a part where Sanshiro is, like, getting drunk. Like, he says it's the only way he can go to sleep because he's, like, still guilty about having, you know, hurt people so bad just by fighting. And somebody even says to him, like, why don't you stop? Like, why don't you lose on purpose? He's like, well, I can't do that. Like, I respect the art so much that it would be just a betrayal if I were not to fight at the top of my game. So I can't lose on purpose. I have to fight. And he decides, in order to get tossed out of the dojo, that he's going to go fight in this boxing match with the American who's back in town, I guess. And so he goes back to the arena, and he fights with the American, and of course, Sugata wins.
After just one throw.
Yep. The guy can't stand. The boxer almost gets up a couple of times, and he can't get up. He's down.
And he,
the guy, yeah. Here. They hand him, like, the 20,000 yen or whatever that he was going to get. Sugata puts it on the American boxer's body and tries to leave, but then the guy who fought the American originally shows up, and he's like, thank you so much. Thank you so much for defeating this guy. You know, like, my life has been ruined since I did that match, and I just, you know, you've brought honor back to the martial arts by doing this. Sugata runs over, gets the money, and gives it to this guy instead, which is kind of funny.
Yeah.
But he has already been given a notice, like, you have to meet with these 2 karate dudes, karate bros. They want them to meet him on this cliffside
fight to the death. Higaki gave Sugata the secret to their family's karate.
Oh, yeah, that's right. He gave him the scrolls.
Yeah. So he has a little cheat code for in case he does choose to fight.
Yeah. He gives it to Master Yano, though, so for the benefit of the dojo.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if he looks at it himself. The monk guy is back, and he's, like, chastising him. Like, well, those rules are there, but they don't mean anything. Like, you have to decide yourself if you're going to leave the dojo or not. There's no way to get thrown out. Basically, is what he tells him.
Yeah,
says
something like, you broke the word of the rule, but did you break the spirit of the rule?
Right.
And Since the god is a pure soul, he has broke the word. He's still devoted to the dojo.
Right. It's basically impossible for him at this point. He's so dedicated to the dojo and the art. So Sagata goes up to the hill, and it's this really cool, like, snowside fight scene that's going to be happening between the Sane, and I'm using quotation marks, brother, because both brothers are there. And they've got a little cabin on the side of this hill that, like I said, it's like in the middle of the blizzard here. And Sagata fights the brother, who is, like I said, he's dancing around, he is yelling, "Aah!" You know, I don't want to make fun of it too much, but he's making a lot of noise. I'm surprised there wasn't an avalanche.
Yeah, so that was actual snow during, like, a snowstorm.
Oh, man.
And apparently...
God, those guys must have been freezing.
Fujita, he would joke with Kurosawa for years about how filming that snow fight scene was awful.
Yeah.
And they're barefoot, just so you know, in like a snowstorm.
Yeah, and they're not wearing furs or anything. They're like both in their gi, so that's not supporting any, you know, heat,
no,
any warmth or anything like that.
That's the devotion to the craft.
Well, good for them. Sagata eventually throws him in such a way that he is defeated. The other karate dude is defeated. And rather than letting him die, he drags him back into their little hovel, where they've got just enough room for the three of them, and there is a small fire. And the next scene we see is the karate person who was defeated is wrapped up, you know, like, to try to get him warm again, and Sagata is making soup for the brothers. Mm-hmm. Like a tasty Japanese burrito.
Yeah, a yummy blanket burrito.
Yep. And he's, you know, Sagata is like almost, he seems like he's having a good time. He's like, "Oh, good, no, I'm going to make some nice food for you. You guys drink this up, you know." The crazy brother is just like sitting in the corner.
I don't think he says anything in the whole movie until...
Not until the end.
Not until the end.
Yep.
And, one of the things Higaki did warn is that this crazy brother is insane, and he couldn't control him if he wanted to. But, you know, they're both refusing the food, and they're both disgusted with themselves or whatever. And Sagata, like, goes to sleep. And while he's asleep, the crazy brother, takes a knife, and he... slowly walks towards Sagata, you know, with the intention of just killing him.
And this is all in one take.
Yeah.
And it's really amazing how it's choreographed in this tight little space, and the camera never... Well, that's cut at some point, but it is a very long shot.
Yeah. And honestly, based on some of the other Kurosawa movies we saw, I wouldn't have been surprised if he had killed him. And then maybe himself and his brother.
Yeah, you know, well, like a trip. Early Kurosawa was more hopeful, then once he got middle-aged, movies got kind of darker.
Right. And the brother does not end up stabbing him. I can't remember why.
Sagata smiles in his sleep.
Oh, that's right. He's having another vision.
Yeah.
Of his babe.
I wasn't sure if that was him doing that on purpose because he sensed something. Like, maybe since an attack, maybe he charmed his way out of it, or if it was, as he happened to smile and sleep. Could he such
I a... See, yeah.
Hmm?
Because he's such a pure soul.
Yeah, he's such a pure soul that smile changes the crazy brother, and he decides, and he says, yeah. "We lost."
Yep, and the other brother says, "Yeah, we lost." And that's basically the end of the movie.
Yeah.
The end of the movie, smiles while washing his face because he's finally able to be happy and sleep.
Yeah, there wasn't as much in this one to really dig into.
No, I'm not sure if Kurosawa wanted to make this sequel.
But he does, you know, he pulls out some of the old tools and stuff like that. But, like, I do think that the end fighting scene is very dynamic. It's very well shot. But the American stuff, the boxer and things like that, it just feels gross. Like, and not because, like, I've got some sort of, like, American loyalty.
Mm-hmm.
It's because it feels weird. It just, it feels like it's shoved into the middle of the movie.
Yeah, it's totally, this makes this movie, like, doesn't, not work. It's not like a Korean tonal shift, like in a, who's that guy? The guy who did Snowpiercer and Okja.
I'm drawing a blank on his name.
Oh, Bong
Joon-ho?
Yeah. Like, he does tonal shifts, but that's kind of his style. Like, a huge tonal shift, where this is, like, it's not, like, intentional. It's just interference from, like, the studio.
Right.
And so it just kind of makes watching this movie is kind of, it goes by fast, but it gets really slow during the American stuff.
Yeah. It's not as interesting as the first one for some reason. And, like, it's still a good movie. It's just not... It doesn't hold up compared to it. I don't feel like it's a story that necessarily had to be told. I do... You know, I like the goofy, crazy characters, but they don't get used that much. They're just kind of, like, obviously evil.
Yeah, like, both these movies are kind of pretty shallow for the most part. There's not much going for them. Like, Kurosawa, these were his least favorite movies he did.
Mm.
Well, there's a movie after this next year called Those Who Are Beautiful. No. Is it Those Who Are Beautiful? No. I have to look it up. It's a movie that he directed that he didn't want his name attached to later on. And it's sure. It's never been... Those Who Make Tomorrow. And it's another propaganda film. He's kind of... Was it propaganda? No. Anyway, it's a movie that he didn't want to make, and it's never been officially released, and he didn't even direct all of it.
I see.
I misremember something. I thought one of the producers of the movies produced his stuff in the 50s, but I got names mixed up, so doesn't matter. Yeah, both films had different producers, weirdly enough. Might explain the tonal difference.
Yeah. It's a different time in the country, you know?
Yeah, that 2 years kind of things dramatically changed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, both producers worked on his next two films, No Regrets for Our Youth, which is the first one with Setsuko Hara, and the movie Those Who Make Tomorrow that is impossible to find. And that's kind of all they did with Kurosawa besides Sugata. Like, I can't find much about them at all. I don't know. If you had to watch one of them, watch the first one. It's the one's definitely more entertaining.
Yeah. I like, you know, neither of them are bad movies, but the first one is better than the second one. And I think that the charm of Susumu Fujita, the main character, he does, you know, like Sugata in the story has this like smile that he does that we've brought up a couple of times, and like his way of doing it, the actors, you know, display the character feature or whatever is just like so charming that it, you know, it's part of the reason that the movies work at all.
Yeah, he is with a great lead, and unfortunately Toshiro kind of stole that muse part from him.
Yeah.
But it's Toshiro, so it kind of, you can't blame him.
I mean, yeah, Toshiro Mifune is like a freaking powerhouse, like unstoppable acting force. We don't see Susumu doing that, but I, you know, there's a lot of other movies that he's in besides Kurosawa movies.
Yeah, he still had a fine career after this. And Kurosawa still kept using him, most famously in Hen Fortress, where he's gets to be a badass again.
Ah, that's okay. So, from 1943, there's a movie called The Life and Death of Colonel Blimp.
Mm-hmm.
Which is a Powell and Pressburger movie. And among film geeks, Powell and Pressburger are, you know, they're a big deal.
I've heard the name.
Yeah, they did The Red Shoes, they did Black Narcissus.
Oh.
You know, Matter of Life and Death. And then I believe Michael Powell went on to do, what is the Peeping Tom, which is Notorious, you know?
Is that where a term comes from?
No, I think it's a term before the movie was made.
43 also has The Mad Ghoul, a movie you cover on your podcast.
Yeah, that one's pretty okay. It's very silly. It's universal, though. But The Life and Death of Colonel Blimp is an excellent movie. Like, I can't even describe why I am, you know, like, I saw it years ago, but I still have this, like, warm feeling in my brain about
it. That was a long movie. According to Google, it's almost 3 hours.
Yeah, as all the best movies are, almost 3 hours. Come on. Hitchcock's Shadow of a Doubt also came out that year. That's, you know, a lot of people's favorite Hitchcock movie, including himself, I think. And from 45...
Yeah, I don't have any from 43. This, there's a Tracy movie from 40. Is it Tracy? Yeah. Spencer Tracy in a movie called A Guy Named Joe.
Yeah, I don't think I've seen a single Spencer Tracy movie.
You should get on that.
I'm busy. So, and for 1945, I've only got, Sanshiro Part 2. I've got The Men Who Tread on Tiger's Tails. And then there's the movie Les Dames de Bois de Boulogne, which is a Robert Bresson movie, who is another one of those, like, it directors for film nerds.
And that's another name I recognize.
Yeah, yeah. He did, like, A Man Escaped, and he's just a kind of a masterclass director.
Balthazar Getty?
Yes, Balthazar Getty. Alhazar Balthazar. Pickpocket, L'Argent, Mouchette.
Oh, I've heard of those.
Yeah, he's done a lot of great movies. And Les Dames de Bois de Boulogne is very good. It's not mind-blowing amazing. You know, it's worth a watch. Like, I think I watched it on Hulu back when they had a Criterion, so I'm not sure if it's part of the Criterion collection.
For 45, there's also Mildred Pierce, which is on Criterion now. It's one of the newer ones. I think it's from the same batch as Multiple Maniacs, the John Waters movie, the one he did before Pink Flamingos.
Yeah, those movies have a lot in common, Mildred Pierce.
Multiple Maniacs,
yeah.
Maniacs has a very disturbing graphic scene in the church that it needs to be seen to be understood.
I've not seen it, but it's not from 1945.
That's so true, but I do recommend Multiple Maniacs if you like filthy John Waters-type movies.
Oh, man, there's like some, there's Rome Open City, which I haven't seen, but is on my list. Because, you know, I freaking love Italian neorealism.
Oh, but, Mildred Pierce is a movie that Joan Crawford won, I think, her only Oscar for. I've been meaning to see it for a while, and now it's on Criterion, so now I probably will definitely see it.
Now you have to.
Yeah. And another movie, I haven't seen it, but I've always been curious about it, Anchors Away. That's a musical where Gene Kelly dances with Tom and Jerry.
Yeah, no thanks.
You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, I know what you're talking about. Gene Kelly danced with a lot of cartoons.
Yeah, like
Donald Duck and
Frank Sinatra's in it.
Oh, Frank Sinatra's a cartoon?
Yeah, basically.
Looks like I got a lot of 1945 movies I need to catch up on. Yeah, so what's next?
The next pairing is 1949. This is not Stray Dog. It's the... I think this is the most overlooked Kurosawa film. It's called A Quiet Duel. It's the second one with Toshiro in it. And it's about a surgeon playing with Toshiro. And your father's in it, obviously.
Of course he is. Yeah.
And Toshiro's a surgeon who accidentally gets syphilis from a patient during an operation.
I hate it when that happens.
Yeah, so it's kind of really hard to find. I paid like $40 for an import DVD. It's not on Criterion. It's just good luck trying to find it.
It's out there. You just have to work for it.
Yeah.
All right.
And the pairing is a Kiyoshida film called Here's to the Young Lady, which has, I think it's, Kiyoshida did a couple of movies with Setsuko Hara. It's one of them, because I'm picking it because of Setsuko.
Yeah.
And she did another movie in 49 that we're going to cover with the Stray Dog. That's the Ozu one, Late Spring. But I'm going to save Late Spring.
All right.
Yeah.
I'll take your word for it.
You have seen Late Spring?
I don't know. I've seen one of them.
It's the one on the cover where she's on the bike.
Oh, yeah. I have seen Late Spring.
Yeah. It's great.
Yeah, it is a great movie, yeah.
Yeah, but, you know, I want to pair a little-known movie with another little-known movie. I don't want to overshadow A Quiet Duel.
All right.
So, somehow you'll get a copy of it. I'm not sure, but you will.
Sure.
And the next very special episode for the month of September is Fires on the Plain with Kevin Davies. As of today, he has seen the movie, and we will record with him at some point this month for a special episode. So, yeah, look forward to that.
Okay. I assume you're talking to me, not the listeners.
Both.
Okay.
Fires on the Plain is on DVD. Oh, yeah, the Kiyoshida Here's the Young Lady is on Filmstruck. And I think it's in the... What is it called? There's some Eclipse Pack series with Kiyoshida that has, like, one called Army with... Never mind. Anyway, it's... You can get it on DVD. It's in some big pack thing or in Filmstruck. Quiet Duel, track it down if you can. And Fires on the Plain is available on Filmstruck and Criterion DVD.
Sounds good.
Yeah. Got stuff to plug.
Well, if you want to hear more of my voice and a couple of other people's voices, you can hear us talk about science fiction and fantasy movies every Monday on Please Don't Send Me Into Outer Space. We just hit our 100th episode, and we had Gary Butterfield from the Watch Out for Fireballs and Bonfire Side Chat podcast on to talk about the movie Willow. And that was a lot of fun.
I've heard of Willow, but never actually seen it.
It's a fun movie. It's not like amazing or anything like that, but a lot of people have nostalgia for it. It holds up, is what I'll tell those people.
All I know is that it's Lucas trying to do a Star Wars but fantasy, right, or something.
No, he's trying to do a Lord of the Rings ripoff.
Oh.
Yeah. Hmm. And directed by Ron Howard.
Interesting.
New episodes every Monday.
Yeah. I finally have a proper the release date for my Grindbin episode, September 13th. This is September 13th. My Grindbin on Coonskin will drop. Look for that. Coonskin is a fascinating movie that's definitely worth watching. It's on YouTube in full if you're curious about it. And you can buy a DVD, which you should. Give Ralph Bakshi some of your money. Because this movie, it's the one Bakshi movie you should actually make a point to buy.
No. What?
It is.
No.
It's kind of his best movie, which isn't saying a lot.
don't tell people to buy that movie.
It's not a bad movie. It's just a bizarre, fascinating thing that happened in the 70s.
Just watch Lord of the Rings or
Wizards.
Wizards, yeah. Watch Wizards. There you go. Fire and Ice. Watch one of those.
Now watch Coonskin. It's kind of his best movie. It's supposed to make you uncomfortable. That's the point. Yeah, you can listen to the tacked end for email and all that stuff.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, we'll see you next time. Thanks for listening, guys.
See you in 2 weeks.
The show's email is highandlowpod@gmail.com. The show's Twitter is @highandlowpod. The show is available on the Google Play Store, Podiant, PODIANT, Podbean, as bean, not beam, and iTunes, and wherever you find your podcast. Thank you for listening.